Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. I hope you are all doing well out there. I hope that you are all getting ready for an amazing, amazing Samhain, Samhain, All Hallows Eve, whatever, all the amazing holidays coming up, everybody. We will be talking tonight in our first segment with Judica Illis. She is the author of the Encyclopedia of Witchcraft. We'll be talking about traditional witching, the idea of witchcraft, its traditional roots, some of the differences between New Age witchcraft, things like that. Because there really is, I wouldn't necessarily say like a fine line difference. I'd say that there is a pretty ground in the ground difference. But a lot of people have misconceptions, Judica. A lot of people have misplaced ideas of the sources of these things, where they come from. So welcome to the show for the first time. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. Halloween and this time of year is one of my favorite times of year. I mean, A, I live in Texas, so it actively means it's not like 98 degrees every single day. At least for like 2.5 months of the year. It's nice. But it really does bring about a lot of these traditions, a lot of these connections, that, quote, thinning of the veil that right. So many talk about during this time of year. And it's one of those, I'm gonna show a few things on screen to kind of get us started and get us going from my library here to kind of spur the conversation. This is from the Key of Solomon. We regularly talk about sigil work, sigil magic, things like that with our friend and guest Nathaniel Gillis whenever we get into demonology and that kind of stuff. There's high magic, you know, which is different than witchcraft in and of itself. There's also astrology, which, yes, folks, I have the Idiot's Guide to Astrology because that's where I started. Because you got to start somewhere, and some of these things, astrology specifically, is very, very thick, and it depends on which discipline of astrology you're studying, things like that. However, as we get close to the bottom of the stack here, herbs and herbalism, now we're getting a little bit closer to actual and traditional magic and witchcraft as we know it. So how did you come to the world of witchcraft to begin with, Judica? Because it is a path that we all come to differently.
Well, you know, everybody asks me that, and I don't have a good answer.
That's all right.
I say I just sort of arrived. I arrived like this with this interest. I have always been interested in witchcraft and the magical arts, astrology, tarot, numerology. I mean, I had some exposure to it in different ways. Mm. In my childhood, I was there when Bewitched was first on television, and the Addams Family, and I Dream of Jeannie. You know, I was lucky. I was there to watch it. You know, I saw Ginger on Gilligan's Island. There's a great episode where she's a crystal ball reader.
Yeah.
And
And where did the crystal ball come from? I thought you were on a boat for 3 hours, man.
Well, it was in one of the boxes and it was intact. So, I mean, that was sort of in the air at that time.
Yeah.
But I also had a family. I wouldn't call them practitioners, but they were interested. My mother taught herself English by teaching me to read when I was like three.
Wow.
And my sister is significantly older, and she was bringing home books on astrology and numerology and all of that. And I basically stole them from her. Mm. So I don't know why I had that interest. I write, but this is true, that we lived in New York City and we were in an apartment building, and I love Halloween too. And some of my earliest memories are of trick or treating, and we would trick or treat inside the apartment building. I always wanted to dress up as a witch. Always. I don't know why, but there you have it. Mm. I read my mother would read me fairy tales. I always identified with the witch. Hansel and Gretel. That's a scary story.
Yeah.
Because those kids kill that witch.
Yeah.
Those rude children who ate her house.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I was one, when I definitely got things from my older brother as well. He was somebody who got interested in tarot cards, things like that. There was one book specifically in the junior high library, and I don't know why it was in the junior high library of the junior high school that we went to, but it was Amulets and Talismans.
Oh, yeah.
And probably the only person with more signatures on that checkout card than me was my older brother. Sure. And that book just fascinated me. It fascinated me seeing. And I mean, it was Amulets and Talismans that went back to Babylon and things like that.
I love them. Those are my favorites.
It was interesting to me to see the way that every culture across the globe had this connection to, like, hey, here's a tchotchke that I need to have in my hand to help me out on the day.
I collect hand amulets. And one, the one I'm wearing now, this is a Navajo one by Navajo artist. But you can find them, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
All over the world. Tibet, everywhere.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because when you start looking at that, specifically the idea of amulet, talisman, that kind of stuff, those are the things that you typically went to your local witch for.
Right.
Was some sort of protectorate device, sort of something to keep the Malaokio away.
Right. Even now, also, I mean, I encourage people to learn how to do it for themselves.
Mm.
I think it's good to empower yourself.
Sure.
You can learn how to do it, and you have to make sure you have someone ethical. Back in the day, I just finished watching this Thai television series with a shaman, and he's a village shaman, so everybody knows him. And everybody knows he's an honest guy, a sincere guy. But sometimes you can leave yourself vulnerable to people who will exploit your fears and your desires.
Absolutely.
So it is better if you can do it yourself. And I do. That's my books. I try to teach people to do these things.
That brings up a very good point, you know, and that is the idea and something that I have tried to express to people. I'm a former Catholic seminarian. I had a great devotion to the Mother Mary for a long time in my life, things like that. And the idea of prayer meets manifestation is so fascinating to me now. And to see, 10 years ago, Judica, maybe, I don't think that the word manifestation in your life would have been used by pastors, but it was definitely, like, the concept was definitely being pushed and put out there.
When I wrote my book, Encyclopedia of 5,000 Spells, which is about 20 years ago now, one of the things that shocked me was how much Catholicism was in folk magic.
Yes.
All this Catholic folk magic, and it's great, and it's very effective. And I have since, learned a lot more. But it was something that was surprising for me at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, it's really interesting because, when you start digging into specifically old saint stories, things like that, no different. no different than we have Saint Blaise, the patron saint of sore throat sufferers.
There's a
patron saint for everything, you know. And it no different than there were minor deities and things like that. And don't get me wrong, people, I know that there's a vast difference between a minor deity and a saint, okay? But when you're talking about the devotion of somebody to something in order to attain, that is no different than lighting a devotional candle on an altar, be it an altar to the juniper tree outside.
Sure.
And that was something that even whenever I taught CCE, this time of year, we would always talk about the very close connection between Dia de los Muertos and All Saints Day, All Souls Day.
Sure.
And those celebrations and Halloween, but also the idea of the whole concept of decorating a Christmas tree comes straight out of Wicca.
Right.
Like it is pulled directly out of the Wiccan tradition of let's give sacrifice of animal parts to Mother Nature and to Gaia, to the tree that stays green through the winter, so that we have a good harvest next year.
There are different forms of tree decoration. Even now, there are, you know, offerings to fairies, requests for healing that involve tying cloths to trees. And often you'll see this, or wells, and you tie a little cloth with the intention that as the cloth deteriorates, so will your illness.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think that...
And these are ancient beliefs.
Yeah.
That, you know, ancient.
Well,
we don't even know how old.
And that's just it. That's one of the misconceptions that I want to get out of people's brains and separate. Because, I mean, quite literally, it's what led to the Malleus Maleficarum and the Hammer of Witches and the Salem Witch Trials. Was the same fervency that we have in today's society, where people are willing to point the finger at something strange that they do not understand out of a means of fear, and akin it to and attach it to things like Satanism and animal sacrifice and stuff like that. It's like, whoa, hold on. These are separate things. Bloodletting and stuff like that is not practiced in typical witchcraft in that kind of way. That misunderstanding. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and once again, like here's examples like runes, tarot cards, that kind of stuff. Yes. Used by other societies, and use by their shamans, that kind of stuff, even cowrie beads, that kind of thing. But going to a diviner, even going to somebody who did, oh my God, the name just left my head, the evisceration in ancient Rome, where they would read the entries.
The augurs.
Even that was different than going to your local witch for a healing or for a poultice or something like that.
Well, you know, it's like, I don't know if this is a good comparison, but you know, there are medical specialists. Sometimes you need a podiatrist. Sometimes you have an eye, ear, and nose issue.
Yeah.
And you may have different kinds of magical issues where you need a general practitioner, you need a specialist, and a reputable practitioner will tell you, in the same way that a podiatrist will tell you, I can't really work on your ear. You know, they may recommend you to somebody else, you know, to give a referral. It is that I always tell people, it's a service. When you go to a card reader or a rune caster or somebody who's doing some sort of a service for you, it is okay to ask for referrals in the same way that, you know, you wouldn't just let a plumber work on your kitchen without getting some sort of a referral or, you know, but witchcraft and magic is such a secret practice, and so many people are embarrassed about it that they don't ask. And that leaves them open to being taken advantage of. You know, I can tell you inevitably, I've done a lot of teaching all over the U.S., and there's always someone who gives you a hard time. There's always someone that, you know, the skeptic with the capital S, and they are giving you a hard time with, you know, what you're... And then at some point after the class, you go into the bathroom, and that person follows you in there and says, well, I didn't want to say anything in front of the other people, but I really need help.
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that brings up a very interesting point, and that is the idea of... do you have to believe for magic to work?
No. If that's like saying you have to believe in an aspirin for it to work. It might not work, but it's got nothing to do with your belief. There are all sorts of reasons why it might not work.
Well, let's start getting into that real quick, because I mean, of course, I think much like any prayer, things like that, I think a lot of things come down to an open-minded, open-hearted interpretation.
I was taught, do you know what the difference is between a prayer and a spell?
Please.
A prayer is a request, and a spell is a demand.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I was taught that long ago, and I find that it is true. A prayer is often thy will be done.
Yeah.
And a spell, and a lot of people come to spells because of some sort of a desperate situation where they either really want something or they're very afraid of something. They don't want something.
Mm.
And the conventional resources aren't working. And so it's a little bit of a, what have I got to lose? Let me try it.
Yeah.
And it's really my will be done. I can't do this. I can't have this experience. Idiopathic infertility, meaning that people don't know why they're, you know, there's no conception and the doctors can't tell you why. And you've hit a point where they can tell you they can't do anything for you, but you really want to have a baby.
Mm.
That's often a gateway into magical practice. Desperation over money.
Sure.
We need a transplant. Some sort of a desperate situation and nothing else is working. So you have nothing to lose. Let's try it. The worst thing that will happen is you'll be at the same place you were before.
Yeah.
And that's often the pathway.
Now, and that brings up a very interesting point. Now, one of the things that through my years of esoteric study, things like that, one of the many things that I have read is Kabbalah. And that really changed a lot of concept for me and also tied a lot of these things together for me, especially the idea that you're talking about the difference between a request and a demand. And for those of you who are out there and saying like, it's beyond your means to demand, no, it is not. And I'll tell you why. And it's a Kabbalistic reason. And that is because, you amongst all of creation, according to the Kabbalah, were uniquely breathed life into by the Creator. And because creation was spoken into being and things were spoken into being, not like cobbled together. He didn't make light out of clay. He said,
right.
Be light. And it was. So because the Creator is able to do that, you are able to do that because you share in that creative spirit. Which is what separates us from the animals, beyond having soul or anything like that, or spirit or higher elevation of intelligence. It's the fact of we can speak and bring things into being with our speaking. So, yeah.
Right. And one of the tenets of magic is to be very careful with your words.
Yeah.
Because you can speak things into creation. And words, once released, you carefully take them back.
Yeah. You can't unring a bell. You can't.
Right, you can't unring the bell, exactly.
and that brings us, I think, into some important territory, something that I've always caveated people with. And that's, hey, whether you can read things out of the, you know, greater, lesser key of Solomon, all kinds of things. Just don't go scrawling things on the ground with intent, you know. Be careful what you start doing in that right, because at that point you are putting full intent into something. Right. And you are doing that magical intent. Even the idea of my candles. I burn typically a candle a day while I sit here at my desk. That was a request from an old friend, Rocky, who was like, you should light a candle every day for 5 minutes. Just if anything, to bring light into the world, but also to remind you that there is light. No matter what, that there's light. And in the last year, I have taken, and I've known of it for years. I've seen kits, all kinds of things, Judica. But in the last year, I have taken to actually inscribing on my candles as I put a prayer into that candle, drawing a symbol that means something to me, and putting that on there and saying, with this candle, I intend this. I put this out into the universe and I ring this bell with this candle. And I do that every day.
It's a great practice.
My son does one. It's his wish candle when he goes to bed, things like that. But the idea of, yes, putting that intent out there, and that's different than a prayer. I'm not hoping that this happens. There's a difference there, and there's a very distinct difference there. Like this, this is, it's not a, I hope this happens. It's a cementing of the fact that this is. And I think that there's a lot of people out there who have a spiritual problem with that, let's just say. How do we begin to, I guess, allay fears of people, to let them know that that's not really the gateway to true evil in that kind of way?
No, the magical arts have been victims of bad press for thousands of years.
Absolutely.
You know, going back to pagan Rome, you know, the historians will tell you that the first witch trial or witch hunt is in pagan Rome, as far as we know, documented, as far as we know. And to some extent, I think, and this is my theory, the authorities, once there is a sort of centralized authority, whether it's a secular or a spiritual or a religious, they are not happy with shamans or witches because they're not obedient. And I think that is the key issue. It's not necessarily evil.
Yeah.
And I mean, and we can go back, you know, I mean, I use the example of the Bible. The witch of Endor, the medium of Endor, she's not a fraud. She's not someone strange. And she's not evil. She does what she's asked to do. And after she delivers bad news, what does she do? She cooks him a meal.
Yeah.
She doesn't have to. So I do understand ambivalence. The ambivalence is also that, I mean, if you're not looking at witchcraft today, where you can go into a store and almost, or go online and you can buy a candle burning kit or a book, but go back thousands of years, 3,000, 4,000, the people who were spiritual leaders, shamans, witches, what we would call, and it goes back to old ironworking clans.
Absolutely.
They knew things other people didn't. They knew which plants did what. Which plants healed. Which plants were poisonous. Which plants were the antidotes. Which plants were psychotropic. how do you mind safely on a spiritual level? Because you're going into Earth and you're pulling out things.
Yeah.
And how do you do it safely? And nobody likes people who know more than you do. I mean, yes, when you need them, but otherwise, it can make you nervous.
Yeah.
So I do recognize that ambivalence. But then you have, you know, and you can go through history, you know, early China kills their shamans. They, you know, kings and emperors, and they tell you, you know, make it rain, and you don't.
Yeah.
Or they ask you a question and you give an honest answer. I'm a card reader, and I do warn people. I will tell you, I deliver things gently. I've learned. I've been doing this for a long time. Mm. But I will tell you what's in the cards. I don't think you can be a card reader and lie, because I think you'll lose your gift. It is a privilege and a blessing to be able to have that psychic connection. And if you misuse it, I think you will lose that ability. So you have to be honest if you like to continue to do it. But that means that sometimes you tell people things they don't want to hear.
Yep.
And, you know, authority doesn't, you know, they want you to tell, they want you to say what they want you to say.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there were definitely, especially within the Catholic Church, sorry, folks, there were a lot of means of control. There were a lot of, I mean, even the fact of you come to salvation through that and that alone.
Right.
Whereas even when you look in the Old Testament, things like that, it's, you take all the plants, use them. Use them for all means. What you avoid, necromancy. You know, like, don't commune with the dead.
Although that's a tricky thing too.
Sure.
Because, I mean, necromancy, what that means is prophesying with the dead.
Yeah.
And people tend to think that means digging up bones or desecrating cemeteries. But if you have ever wished to have a dream of grandma.
Yeah.
You know, if you have ever wanted to ask grandma, where did you hide the silverware? That's necromancy.
Well, and you know, that's it's. Hey, Judica, call me crazy. Whether or not I use a Ouija board, I ain't having one in my house.
Oh yeah, me too. and I mean, a Ouija board is ultimately it's a board with writing
board.
On it.
Nothing more.
Yeah.
Nothing more. Once again, it's, I mean, the intent behind
it. I mean,
that.
Not to freak people out.
No.
I mean, can it be used as a portal?
Sure. Yes. Absolutely.
But so can a mirror.
That's right. So can a wreath of holly, if you wanted to. Like, you could take sticks and make a square and say, hey, man, this is my portal. If you want to. It is what you're empowering and putting that vibration into.
Right. Right. So, you know, it could just be a board. There are these beautiful spirit boards that are hand-painted. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful. And people use them as works of art. And they never use them for anything else. It's just a painted board. But there are people who use mirrors.
Absolutely.
And glasses of water.
Yep.
There's the old, you can polish your thumbnail and gaze into it.
Absolutely.
You know, so if somebody really wants to do it, it's very hard to, it's very difficult to stop someone.
And you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I actually have sitting right here on my desk my gazing crystal, which I do not use, just so you know, folks, I do not use that in any way, shape, or form for, quote, scrying the future. I respond to the future as a karate expert would, as it comes to me. I have no interest in scrying the future, things like that. What I use it for is a point of meditation and a point of direct focus. No different than carrying my crystal in my pocket on the daily whenever I go out in the world. It is a point of grounding and connection for me, which is once again what the intent is. You could put all kinds of intent behind your crystals or what have you. But it's the intent and that vibration. And that brings us to something which I think is really important, which is one of the main, at least traditional rules of witchcraft, which is that threefold rule, the idea that, you know, any energy you put out goes around three times and comes back kind of in a boomerang fashion. And I remember go ahead.
I was going to say, that's a variant of what you reap, you shall sow.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's just it, you know. And there was, I remember I told you there would be one political moment here, but it's not a red-blue moment. It's a consequence moment. Because yeah. I remember during the first Trump election, there was a coven of witches that was casting a spell again. And then during the second election, they did it again. And it's one of those like, hey, man. You want to quit casting ill-intended spells around? It was one of those, like, pretty sure you're supposed to, like, do no harm, kind of in that doctor kind of way.
Well, there is a difference between witchcraft and Wicca.
Yes.
And the do no harm is Wicca. That's not necessarily true of everyone, but I will say, as someone who writes about spell casting,
yeah,
teaches methods, it is much more effective. The more detailed and personal you can make a spell, the more likely it is to work. You should be able to visualize it.
Yeah.
And that's why it is a lot easier to cast a spell for peace in your home.
Yes.
You know, that's very valuable. Yes. And peace in the whole world.
Yeah.
What does peace in the whole world even look like? You should be able to see, you know, you should have a personal goal that you want and that you can really see accurately. And healing somebody you know is a lot more so-and-so's in the hospital and I love them and I want them to get better. Most spells are positive. I think it is better to work from, if you work from love and respect,
yes,
you will be okay.
Yes.
Angry people cast angry spells. Angry people do a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, angry people shouldn't drive cars either. Not when they're angry.
Truth.
You know.
Truth. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that is a really good way to put that.
I wouldn't want some surgeon operating on me if he was in a really, really, really bad mood.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, the thing with spellcasting and magic and witchcraft is it is real life. I think for a lot of people, it's a fantasy.
Mm.
Or it's like one night a year, Halloween.
Yeah.
But this is some of our oldest human behavior. We see archaeologists and anthropologists, they look at Neanderthal burials. They had rituals.
Absolutely.
So this is something we're very hardwired to. And depending on the culture, this might be part of your everyday life. Or it might not be. It might be something you want to avoid. But it is very much human behavior. And it is better if you are doing it. If you're going to do it, you should do it in a constructive, and I would say loving way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you bring up a really good point, and that is the craft end of witchcraft. Because things that, especially in traditional witchcraft, were never attained easily. They were never, nothing was ever rushed. Even if you look at the fact of a candle, this is a little bit different. Like, these are Shabbat candles, straight beeswax, things like that.
Sure.
You know, but I buy these off Amazon. Now, if you were doing this in a traditional way and I was coming to see you, Judica, and you would be, you know, making a candle for my hand fasting with my bride-to-be, you would literally be putting that magical, beautiful intent into every single dip of wax.
I would make a candle from scratch. I would hand dip a candle, or get wax.
The idea of like that spell is woven and that intent is put into every single time you dip the wax. It's another layer of that. And it builds on it, like rings on a tree. The power of that spell builds in that kind of way.
You know, even the candle that you have, these things have become very accessible to us. 300 years ago, a wax candle was very expensive.
Absolutely.
You know, people used tallow or oil. They would put a wick in oil. To have a candle, that was prohibitively expensive to burn a candle every day. And things like, you know, salt is such a magically powerful item.
Yeah.
And now you go to a fast food, you know, you go through the drive-thru at any fast food place, and they are throwing packets of salt and pepper in your bag like it's nothing.
By kosher pound by the half, or kosher salt by the half pound for $5. You know, things like that.
Right. But it wasn't. And the reason people like to use kosher salt for spells is because it's blessed.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, it's prepared in a very traditional way as well. You know, it's the fact of like you were still hard evaporating that salt water to make it happen the same way they did in the desert.
It is prepared in a mindful way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of things that, and of course, salt used to, you know, the word salarate derives from salt, the same word. You know, people worth their salt. It was expensive.
Yeah.
And precious. And now these things are we don't really necessarily respect it as much as we should, or value it as much as we should. So the ability to sort of see the magic and what have become common everyday things, that's very valuable.
Well, and, you know, especially when you're looking at even the idea of black candle versus white candle, things like that. Why different colors for different spells, Judica? Well, for different intent, things like that. This is no dark intent, everybody, just so you know, just because it's black.
Well, I always caution people not to put values on colors. The sort of core belief of magical philosophy is that everything radiates some kind of a power.
Mm.
Whether it's a color, a number, the ancient Greeks thought vowels had more power than consonants. And they radiate this power. And so you kind of want to organize the stuff so that it is doing what you want it to do. And the example I usually give is we have all walked into a room and felt happy.
Mm.
Something in it could be the perfume, it could be the color of the walls. We felt happy in that room. And we've all walked into a room, and it's often a doctor's office, their waiting room, and have felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And sometimes what we need to do is just rearrange things, move the chairs around, you know, do something, and you will feel better. But that's a magical act. And so the different colors radiate different powers. And they're often not what people expect. Black is actually traditionally a color of protection.
Yep.
In ancient Egypt, what we would call black magic, they called it red magic. Versus in other cultures, red is an extremely positive color. But for the Egyptians, it was an ambivalent color. So you can't necessarily assume that this is a bad color and this is a good color. They're all beautiful colors. The world is full of colors.
Yeah.
And they just all kind of radiate a different force.
Indeed. And even the idea of once again, going back to herbology and even the idea of astrology and its connection with that. It was very common to know which herbs and things were blooming or even had their best medicinal value during different cycles of the nighttime sky, things like that.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned before the veil being sheer, being thin at this time of year, but if you follow astrological sites, a significant number of planets are now in astrological water signs, which intensifies the sheerness of the veil. And when we say the veil, for people who are not familiar, you know, there's this sort of belief that there are many realms. You know, the human beings live in a realm. We have the mortal realm, but spirits maybe live in a different realm, and there are different realms of the dead. Like where different people might go to different afterlife realms, and not just a heaven and a hell, but a positive, like, you know, Italian afterlife versus Chinese afterlife versus Jewish afterlife versus, you know, you can, and what separates them is like a curtain. It's like a big catering hall where they may be having different functions going on at the same time, and but there are dividers, walls between them, or curtains between them. And at some times of the year, that veil kind of gets very sheer, which means you can crash another party. Or they could come to visit you. And so you may find at those times of the year, you find yourself thinking of your loved ones who are no longer here more than you do at other times. And maybe you miss your mom, and then you kind of think you saw a glimpse of her, you know, maybe in the kitchen where you used to see her, and you come downstairs and it's like, oh, look, there's mom at the stove again. And then you realize she's not. It's, you know, is it just a trick of the mind, or is it that sheerness of the veil?
Yeah.
And if you do want to speak to loved ones or dream of loved ones who are no longer with us, it's a easier time to do it than at other times.
Interesting. Now let's explore that for a minute, because once again, that idea of being able to connect, that idea of how do we connect, how do we begin that connection, even with ourselves, which we'll be getting into in the next. I wanted to pair this with Keith Click, our next guest, because a lot of his work with Ape Mindset is teaching people that situational awareness in the real world. And that's something that I used to try to teach my CCE kids all the time. Was the example I gave was a kite string. And the fact of one day you will walk into a room with your friends and you will feel that kite string pull. And it may be good, it may be bad. But when you turn around and tell your friends, that will be the immediate measure of their friendship. Because if they don't listen to you or your need to leave the room or whatever, you need to hard consider that friendship right now because they may not have your best interest at heart. And that tuning into that being aware of that literal synchronous, very small, tiny moment. But being open to that moment of when to do things. And, you know, it's interesting because, yes, when you start getting into high magic, when you start getting into things like solemnic magic and that kind of stuff, it is very specific as to when these things are done, like down to the astrological minute. Yes. Like it must be during this day of a full moon during the time of Mercury, and things like that. So it's fascinating to see those alignments between things. How do people begin to tune themselves in to that moment?
Well, I think people have callings and you have to sort of listen to yourself. You find that you have proclivities. Some people, I mean, my sister brought home a deck of tarot cards when I was six, and I fell in love with them. But other people might fall in love with something else. And some people fall in love with that high magic, that ceremonial magic.
Yeah.
And other people fall in love with kitchen witchcraft, you know, casting your spell with what's in your kitchen. So a lot of it is a reflection of yourself. For people who are interested in that high ritual magic, ceremonial magic, that is very literate magic. Mm. It is the magic of educated people. And so there are resources. There are almanacs and books called ephemerides, which are tables and tables of astrological, you know, occurrences. You could look up, I want to get married in June of 2027. And you can go on the, you know, and find an appropriate aspect.
Mm.
So you can learn that. There are resources for that. That is, I don't want to say it's not instinctive or intuitive, because there is an element of instinct and intuition sure. in it, but it's also educated. I mean, you said something very interesting before, Chris, about not drawing like symbols or words in the earth.
Yeah, yeah.
I always caution people, and this is important. Don't say anything you don't understand.
Yes.
Be careful for words and languages you don't understand. Be careful, abracadabra actually means something. I mean, it is in my book of 5,000 spells, yep. or hocus pocus, or all these words. They come from someplace, but sometimes people will give you words, alakazam, whatever it is, and you just say it because somebody else said it. Don't do that. You should know what you're saying. And if you say it in plain English, say what you want and think about your words. If you have a goal, make sure that as you are expressing it, you're not being ambiguous, or you're not, make sure your intent is what you really want.
Yeah.
You know, your heart may want, you might be saying something because you think it's what you should want, but your heart wants something else. And so you need to explore those. The right. It is a diminishing spell to diminish illness.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, understanding that, grasping that, and even it's something that I bring up regularly, being Roman Catholic and coming from that, or sitting right over here on my shelf is the rite of exorcism in Latin and things like that. It is rooted in high magic. Right. It is even the regular psalmody that we read in the seminary of being a priest in the order of Melchizedek of old. Melchizedek was like the high priest of high priests. He was the one that taught the magical ways to the high priest of, this is how you treat the Ark of the Covenant so that you can safely touch it. This is the breastplate that you wear with the protective rocks and minerals on it that create right. the chest plate of the high priests. Things like that.
Some people don't like the semantics. You know, we might call it something else.
Yeah.
But psalms have been used in magical practice.
Absolutely.
Since they've existed. And there are tables, this spell, this psalm, recite this psalm this many times for protection.
Yeah.
Recite this psalm this many times for prosperity or healing or, so it is a significant magical tool. The line between religion and the magical arts is very thin sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is a very, very beautiful way to put that, because they truly are one and the same. Even in the fact of, you have entrusted your path to the priest to instruct you how to get there. That's no different than asking Merlin for direction along your way, when you get down and boil it, like you said, boil it down to semantics, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. It is the same thing. And yeah, even the idea of watching what you say, that rings right back to what we were saying before about being careful with your words, because your words vibrate. They move into the universe, and they move the universe. I have even in the last 2 years, Judica, taken a hard line on the commandment of taking the Lord's name in vain. And my line is this: it's not using curse words or saying God in that kind of way. What it is the fact of, you were given this. You were bestowed that above all creation. The angels can't make things. They can't do that. We can command them. The same way Solomon did. We are given the power over them. So the fact that we are given that power of creation in the universe means probably 90% of the time that we are pleading to God to help us, we should actively be helping ourselves. And that is taking the Lord's name in vain. The fact that, like, no, you should be able to handle this on your own. I've given you the tool to do it. When you're not able to manifest it, that's when you come to me. But I've given you the tools of manifestation. I've given you this means by which to vibrate the universe and change it around you. Go do it. Be fruitful. Multiply. You know, in that kind of way. And that is now my interpretation of that, is the fact of we are supposed to be doing that ourselves. All of us.
Well, you know, there is a parallel with that, with spellcasting. It's not enough to sit in your room and, you know, buy tools and herbs and crystals and cast spells. Let's say you are seeking employment. The spell itself is not enough. You also have to look for that job.
You still got to look.
Right. You have to put yourself out there and go look.
That's right.
I mean, you can,
yeah.
You can pray to win the lottery. You can cast spells to win the lottery.
Still got
to
buy a ticket.
You have to buy a ticket.
Still
got to
buy a ticket. And yeah, and I used to tell that to my CCE kids all the time. You could pray. Believe me, I tried. I prayed hard, and I put a lot of credits into the universe, space credits as I call them, serving my God and serving my church. None of that made me learn geometry. I couldn't pass geometry by praying. I had to actively, and God oddly wanted me to study geometry. He'd love to know the means by which, he'd like me to know, but the means by which he created the universe. So please, learn your geometry, kids.
But these are complementary.
They are. You have to study. It's that, you said, it is that high magic moment, and the idea of, no, you're expected to excel now. You're now expected to be part of the advanced class in school, which means there's going to be a little bit more homework for you.
There's going to be that geometry.
Yeah. You know,
computers do it now, but back in the day, you couldn't study astrology without knowing geometry.
That's right.
It's an integral part.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's funny because when you start looking into those esoteric traditions that reach back, when you start looking into Masonic traditions, stuff like that, they really do ring a lot of these capital T truths that are universal truths that are there across teachings. Jason Quitt is a good friend of this show, and his work is amazing about the relation of geometry and sacred geometry within the symbology of ancient Egypt,
right.
And the astrological alignments, things like that, that are there, because you have to understand that it is the recurring cycle in the sky. And if you don't understand that, your society lives or dies by that. That's when you plant. That's once again, when, even whenever we have Graham Phillips on, that's one of the things he talks about with like Stonehenge, things like that is, oh no, it was a calendar that was made to be there to mark things like right. when mistletoe berries were actually useful and not just poisonous. Like there's a very small window of time where they are medically useful. The rest of the time they will kill you. But it's during a very specific phase of the moon during a very specific time of year. And if you are not aware of that alignment and if you aren't watching it in some kind of clock kind of way, you're going to miss it and you may kill somebody, you know,
right.
Things like that. So it's,
so that is that secret knowledge.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Some people knew and some people had, you know, you have to have the trained eye to see it.
Yeah.
And then other people attempt to mimic that. Or I don't have to pay the specialist. I'm going to do it myself. And, you know, and somebody dies.
Yeah.
So it is a stressful.
And once again, I think it's stressful for people to get things highly mixed up. And don't get me wrong, the teachings of Anton LaVey are very interesting. The teachings of Aleister Crowley, things like that. Absolutely fascinating. Feel free to read them, folks. But remember that what they were doing was different than traditional witchcraft. They were doing things in a very high magic ceremonial kind of way. Not in the traditional witching kind of way. And like you said earlier, as we've said with our friend Anne Celine, whenever we've had her on talking about things like this, you're talking about much more hearth magic, things like that, hearth and home, where you're talking about right. safety of family, keeping evil spirits away, that kind of thing, much more warding things off and welcoming practical, good spirits.
Yes. Practical everyday.
Yeah.
Practices. That once upon a time, it is not like having to figure out that narrow window
yeah.
when a mistletoe berry is safe. It is things that maybe would have been done in every household as part of keeping a family safe and nourished and protected.
Well, let's chat about that in the last few minutes. How can people... Sure. In a non-confrontational way, in that kind of thing, in a modern day and age, how can people apply these concepts to their household? How can they affect their happy home in that kind
of
way?
I will leave you with a very simple one. It is actually a form of Russian spellcasting that is known as very traditional, old, known as whispering. And it is while you're cooking to whisper blessings or desires. You know, you serve someone a drink and, you know, you whisper the words and you know, and they don't have to be fancy words and they don't make them complicated. Don't make them so long. Be healthy. Be well. Be happy. I hope you pass your test today, you know, for a child.
Yeah.
May the other children be nice to you, you know, and even these little things that you do, that consciousness, I will say that with the magical arts, even if you do nothing else, it will sharpen your eyes and your ears. And maybe you will see when your child comes home and is troubled from school a little easier. And then you can take whatever kind of an action you feel is best, whether it is a practical, mundane action or a magical action. And a magical action could be some sort of a little amulet that you encourage someone to wear. And I would tell you that it will have a magical impact. But if you don't believe that, it could also just give you more confidence.
Absolutely.
The sense that you're protected. And that you're loved.
Yeah.
And that's a very important thing.
It's a hugely important thing and something that we bring up regularly on the show, especially as a binaural beat musician, things like that. It's something I bring up regularly is frequency is not just a sound or a color. It is your thought form. Mm-hmm. It is how frequently are you thinking something? Good or bad?
To the world.
Good or bad? Because once again, every time you think it, you're ringing the bell. You know, and you can't take that back. You can't take the ringing of the bell back. It's out there in the universe now. It's vibrating. Did you think positively or negatively?
Taking control.
Yeah.
Taking control of yourself.
And absolutely.
You're cooking and you're angry and you're stirring and your emotions are going into the food. You can stop. And I am feeding people I love, even if they aggravate me. I love
That's
them
right.
and I want them to be well. And
yeah.
I'm going to focus on that.
Yep.
And it goes into the food and they eat it. And it's just a process.
Absolutely.
And a frequency.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And, I will say one of the ways I start my day every day, and I thank my brother for this. You can't really see it on the phone. It's called Galaxy Tarot. Maybe that'll be better. There you go. But I do not do spreads and things like that. Once again, I don't use tarot for divination. I use it for meditation, and it's literally... I draw a single card and I look at it and I look for ways in which that message is echoed throughout my day, things like that. So whatever it takes for you to have that moment of presence of mind before you begin your day, even, is very important, Judica. We have to remember that we ground ourselves. Yeah, thank you so much for your time tonight. It's been a great conversation. I greatly appreciate it. Absolutely.
So
I look forward to having you back on again and again. These conversations, especially when it comes to manifestation in life and bringing things to life in your life, I think is one of the most important conversations out there, because it really is where we get to put ourselves into the universe, you know, and where we get to fold reality in the way that we need it to be folded.
Right.
And we can do it. It's absolutely amazing. So thank you so much for your time. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to contact you for services, where they can come to contact you for lessons, where they can go to get books, everything else, Judica.
Well, my books are available really wherever fine books are sold. I am lucky. I have publishers with great distribution. And I'm online. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I have a website that needs a little bit of work, but I'm told it's, semi-functional. And, I don't think I am teaching for the rest of the year, but I will probably be teaching some classes in 2026.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, once again, I want to thank you for your time tonight. It's been great. We'll be in touch with links for the show,
Thank you.
You take care, and we look forward to having you on again.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Take care, Judica. Man, incredible conversation, everybody. Make sure to stop on by. JudicaIlis.com is where you can find Judica. That is where you can find her Encyclopedia of 5,000 Spells, as well as the Encyclopedia of Witchcraft, and so much more. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by Keith Click of ApeMindset.com. We will be talking about situational awareness, not only situational awareness in the world around us and how to tell good from bad, that kind of stuff, but also situational awareness within the paranormal community, how you can begin to separate wheat from chaff with the stories out there, especially things like Three Eye Atlas and all that kind of stuff. We will be right back after this quick break with Keith Click from ApeMindset.com right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying tuned, and also thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. They are your source for amazing CBD products. I have traveled the country going to various dispensaries during my time on the road over the last decade, and True Hemp Science has some of the most amazing products that I have found. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the plant is used and reused. Everything from the buds and leaves to the stems to the seeds to the roots. Every part used, combusted, reused, and combusted and reused again to provide an amazing spigeric product full of terpene profiles. Great benefits. Stop on by. Check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more with the code CURIOUS7 and get two, count them, two free edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Keith Click. He is the founder of ApeMindset.com. We met Keith at the Psy Games this last year, and I thought it was amazing that he is actively out there with Ape Mindset, teaching people in the everyday world not only situational awareness, but the idea of intuition as part of that situational awareness, the idea of being connected to not only yourself, but the way you're connected to the world around you, which is one of the most important things that we talk about on this show. Welcome back, Keith. How are you doing, my friend?
Good, Christopher. Thank you for having me back.
I am excited to have you back. This, I think, is some of the most important stuff in the world. Self-realization and actualization, especially as a male in America, is hard enough to begin with. But it really is the root of so many solutions to things like we talked about last time we had you on, personal anxiety, things like that. It is that situational awareness of knowing yourself, your body, and knowing the physiological response of your body to the space around you. You know? So, how did you first come, because we're going to talk a little bit tonight, folks, not only about that situational awareness in situations, public situations, but also situational awareness when it comes to paranormal communities, when it comes to feeling things out in communities, when it comes to separating wheat from chaff, truth, fact from fiction. There has been so much, like we've been talking a lot lately, Keith, as you've probably seen in our groups about, 3i Atlas, things like that. And there is such an easy A, point of division that happens with these topics, but also B, the want of tunneling of the brain, the way that it feeds into the brain and the way that that A creates a click monster, but B also creates almost a Frankenstein's monster, a golem of manifesting negative things and bringing about negative things. And it's strange to see. How did you first come to the world of situational awareness? How did you come to the world of statement analysis? Things like that, Keith.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on it a little bit just now. We talked a lot when we were together here a few months ago, but really it was understanding myself and understanding how I navigated the world. I had horrible anxiety, whether it was situational, general, it was just anxiety in my mind. And it was holding me back. Mm. And I didn't really understand it. I didn't know why or what was causing it. So I'm somebody who is, I'm driven. I am motivated. I'm resourceful. So I just went, you know, as we all say, I deep dived right into it. So the original, the start was to understand myself better. But as I started understanding why I felt the way I did, why my body was doing what it was doing, why I felt certain ways when I was out in public, around certain people in certain situations, it started to somewhat make sense to me. And I said, wow, if I feel this way, and if other people have to feel this way, and if I can see this in another person, then I'm going to be able to recognize that. And if I can recognize that, I'll understand, oh, that person's feeling the same way I'm feeling. That's someone I can gravitate towards. So it's kind of building that tribe, that connection, which is important to us. And that's important to our safety. So again, you know, that hypervigilance allowed me to seek out other people that looked stressed, anxious, and that's who I would gravitate towards.
Yeah.
And then I got good at that. Well, I said, well, what is every, cause I was only locked in on that because my brain was focused in on, I needed what was familiar, what was safe for me. But as I got more comfortable in my own skin and comfortable around other people, I started thinking, well, what are the other people doing? Are the other people watching me? Are they looking at me? Do they know I'm only seeking out folks that are stressed, anxious like I am? And I started looking at everybody. And the one big takeaway was no one's paying attention to you whatsoever.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, they're not, they're in their own worlds. They're thinking about their day-to-day life. They're running on autopilot. It took me a little while to understand that. But as I was watching other folks, I watched their interactions with each other, and I didn't know it at the time until I started training with folks that have a whole lot more knowledge than I do. But I didn't know it at the time, but I was actually weaponizing my hypervigilance. I was weaponizing my anxiety, and I was getting really good at it. And this is something that we can touch on later. I can go a little deeper into right now. What I was doing was actually conditioning myself to operate under stress, to operate within that anxiety and still look like I was okay. I was normal. I'm not saying that's healthy whatsoever.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing that we do with military and all that. You're conditioned.
That's right. You know, yeah.
Under that stress. Again, at the time I didn't know that. As I started training and learning from, the real, the folks that teach this, I was ready and I was really good at it. And that was the moment that it got real for me. I was like, wow. I'm no longer just an anxious child, teenager, adult. I'm somebody now that through my own, whatever it is, my own necessity to just stay alive in this world, conditioned myself to operate at the highest level under stress and anxiety. And that's exactly what, you know, folks are looking for when they want to send somebody in to do something that's would normally stress out somebody or they would cave. You know, I could go in and I could turn things on and off. I could become different, you know, because I was okay with it because I'd learned to operate. My heart rate wouldn't go up. I wouldn't sweat. I wouldn't get nervous. I could have a normal conversation and, you know, have whatever I needed to tell that person, I could tell them. And it would just roll right off because, well, I was used to being stressed and I was used to operating in that level. Now it was okay. I understood it as now it almost became a game for me. It became a way that I was winning. You know, I had somewhat beat it without pharmaceuticals, without anything else. Well, one, because I was stubborn, but, the other reason was I just truly wanted to navigate the world without that feeling. And learning how to do it, you know, purposefully man, it changed everything.
Well, and you know, we had a lot of discussion during your last appearance about consent and the idea of consenting your thought form, and especially the frequency of thought form into that, whether it's good or negative. You know, and yes, I would say it is a huge part, especially of military conditioning, field military conditioning, the idea of being able to still operate under stress, being able to still perform under stress. And it's not an easy thing to do. A lot of people think it's an easy thing to do. It really isn't. And that's where a lot of behaviors, a lot of things really come bubbling up to the surface is when those moments of stress, not only hit, but when those moments of stress are also questioned, you know, which is where you can start getting into that statement analysis part of things, that idea of, and there are two different concepts when you're taking a statement. We talked a little bit about this with Joe Franks from while we were at the Remote Viewing Association this year. There's of course good cop, bad cop. You know, that idea of coming in and just understanding and being empathetic and things like that. But there are some people who that is a disingenuous vibration coming off of them. And then there are other people who are amazing bad cops. And then there are people like me who, you know, when I play bad cop, it kind of shows that I'm playing bad cop, you know. And it's funny because, you can flip that on and off. But at the same time, there is still an initial emotion inside of there that you can kind of intuit and get into. And that's kind of what I want to talk about, especially when it comes to the paranormal, you know, because there is that, not asking confrontational questions. Like I've come up with the protocol for the first group therapy, kind of AA style. And the idea is not asking questions, letting people talk, letting people be forthcoming, not being confrontational with them, things like that. But there also comes a time, especially when you're taking a statement, when you're talking to a witness in a statement kind of way, in an investigative kind of way, where you may have to confront their belief system. You may have to confront their experience with a hard and honest question that you need answered, you know. So how do you begin to, A, onboard that person to that concept? Because you really do have to kind of, each person is a different critter that you have to lure onto the ramp of that point of the conversation. But how do you begin to, I guess, spot that deception whenever you see it, Keith?
Yeah. So before you even get into spotting deception, because, you know, there's no absolute when it comes to spotting deception. So really what you're looking for is change in behavior. Clusters, culture plays a big background in this, but it's really that change. So first things first, when you meet someone or when you're inviting them in for an interview, or you have to walk into a room where they already are, there are some standard, some protocol that you will see, whether it's a interview or an interrogation, a full-on interrogation. But ideally, as the person doing the questioning, you want to establish authority and compliance right off the bat. The human brain is designed to follow authority. Humans are the only species that will follow an unstable leader. That's how conditioned we are to follow authority. So the moment you have, you know, you're talking to, let's say, a bad guy, and you're in a suit, you have a badge, you're in a police station, you know, you brought them down in a cop car, you've managed to establish authority, right? So now you need compliance. And the good cop, bad cop, it works on TV. And I think, you know, in some cases it works. And, you know, I think our government got in trouble a little while ago trying to do the good cop, bad cop thing.
Yeah, yeah. To the extreme.
Yeah, but, you know, to just give a little history on some of this questioning and interrogation, you know, we learned all of our interrogation techniques from a Nazi, officer that came over, that we invited over, and he taught us how to do this because they were interrogating our soldiers, and he was getting all this information by simply just talking, by walking around the courtyard with these injured war fighters. And just getting information, offering them cigarettes or juice and getting tons of information. So again, but what he was doing that we know now was he was building rapport and he was building compliance. The moment I offer you something and you take it, now your brain is stuck in limbo and it has this weird, gap that it needs to feel. It needs to give something back to you. And it's that reciprocity. So I'm giving you juice. They ask you, would you like a water? You take it. I'm building compliance. So you're really being nice. You're building compliance and the authority. Now, after you've settled in, you ask questions that you know there's absolutely no reason for this person to lie to you about. Oh, okay. Give me your birthday, your name, date of birth, simple questions. They're going to give you the answers. And what you're doing is you're baselining. You know, you're going to hear all over the internet and you got to watch for the eyes. That's not, again, that's not fully true. It's change. You're going to, sometimes we go in this certain directions when we're looking for information, but it's not always 100% accurate. You have to get really good at baselining and identifying that for yourself. So you've established a baseline. Now you're going to get into some simple questions. You know, let's say, do you have a, you know, you want to give me a scenario and I'll kind of go into like how the questions would go. Do you have a scenario in mind and we can kind of work through that so we can show the folks that even on the fly, you know, we can, I can do this and it's.
Absolutely. I would say you've actually posted a couple of videos. Let's bring one of those up.
For sure.
And this is the first one of a lady who's been questioned. Let's see here.
So the problem is your DNA is in his back wallet pocket.
Oh yeah.
Inside his back wallet pocket.
Well, I don't understand how that is. I don't.
DNA doesn't lie. People do.
Yes.
Just tell the truth. Okay. You're taking yourself into the people hole. Okay.
But I didn't really offer that.
No, but here's the thing.
Yeah, so that actually, what you're seeing there, it's a quick 27 seconds or 20 seconds. And it was a good clip because it shows you what a person's doing. They've turned up the stress a little bit.
Yeah.
They have the answers, right?
Yeah.
So that's why they're asking these questions. And they present to her, well, your DNA was in his pocket. Now, an innocent person would say, no, it wasn't, because it wasn't.
Yeah.
Simple answer. No, it wasn't. She doesn't deny. She can't deny it because she doesn't know how much information they have. So now it's a non-answer. It's a non-denial. That's high. That chart that I showed you earlier.
Yep.
That's really high on the score of deception there. And if you start to cluster it together, that's Chase Hughes, the behavior table of elements. You can download that. You know, that is awesome. Chase is an amazing dude. But it's very high on that. You have to score at least 11 or above to really start getting into deception. But all the way at the bottom, you'll see where it says NA, non-answer, and it's a 4. So we're already up there, and we're not even done with the clip.
Yeah.
And then he tells her, listen, you really need to tell the truth here. She, again, non-answer, no denial. And she says something, I think she says, like, well, I don't know. I didn't flip him over. That wasn't even relevant.
Yeah.
So again, she can't deny it. And, she's given non-answers. But the other cool thing there is the blink rate. And I added that in there. So your average human blink rate on a normal day, no stress, low stakes environment, is like 14 to 17 blinks per minute. When I was watching that, I think I counted 22. So a few times that and then that, small 20 seconds. So, you know, that's up in the 60s. That's when someone is extremely stressed out, when that blink rate is going. And then
there's a lot of blinking going on there.
So, and then we have shutter speed. So shutter speed is the rate at which you close your eyes. And the reason why we do that, your brain is unconsciously blocking things out.
Yeah.
So we blink to kind of like hide it and say, I can't believe I'm saying that, or that happened to me.
Yeah. It's almost like a reset.
It's called an eye, in my world, it's called an eye block.
Okay.
And you can also see that too when, let's say you were talking to somebody who, since October, it was domestic violence month. But if you were talking to somebody who's experienced some domestic violence, when they're being questioned about maybe the person that was abusing them, you know, they might say something like, well, you know, it was okay. It wasn't anything bad. But when they say that, and if they close their eyes and they do an eye block, I would know that, okay, I'm going to let them finish, and then I'm going to go in and say, oh, you know, it wasn't that bad. Like, just, I'm going to elicit information because I know that's a red flag. I know it's an eye block. I know they're blocking something out. Something happened. I would simply say, not that bad. That's it. And I would shut up. And they're going to fill that space, because silence, saying less, is the key to getting more information.
Hmm. And explain that real quick, because I think that's very counterintuitive for a lot of people. Silence is the way to get more explanation.
So again, I said earlier, you're looking for change, clusters, and culture. So culturally, we all have a limited amount that we're willing to stay silent. And I think Americans actually have the least amount of patience. I believe, and we can fact check me, but I believe Japan or China, they may have the highest tolerance for silence in between. But what's happening there is when two people are talking, you have that awkward moment, we call it, or that awkward silence. You feel, it's cognitive dissonance. You feel so uncomfortable inside that the only way to ease that is to say something. And then you speak, and it makes you feel better. I think, you know, they talk about it in sales, you know, the person who speaks first loses, right, during the deal and stuff like that. But it truly just comes down to that uncomfortable feeling that you have inside, because again, it all comes down to safety and survival. When there's that awkward gap there, we feel like we're being judged, socially judged, you know, and we want to make up for that. We want to ease that tension.
Wow. According to this, the Canadians and Americans are generally uncomfortable with more than a second.
Yeah.
Of
that's
silence.
What I'm saying.
And I can tell you that so much so, I used to do a lot of recovery editing for podcasts, and that's what people would want to get rid of more than anything, more than stammers, things like that, with silence. Yeah. And it's like, somebody is being contemplative at that moment. It's rarely the fact that, like, there's just a dead lull in the conversation. Normally somebody is like organically thinking about something. So even the idea of rushing that form of conversation, and even the idea, again, because I say it all the time when people ask me, like, oh, you know, how long does it take you to edit an episode? I'm like, I don't edit. I volume match. I do things like that to curate the sound. But aside from that, like, hey, if I went through and started really editing, man, I can make you say whatever the heck I wanted, Keith. You want to talk about, like, twisting words and stuff that.
Sure.
Like, a good editor can do amazing things, and you will never ever notice. And that becomes a dangerous thing in and of itself.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so even that idea, once again, though, of the silence, even as somebody, and I'll use the term interrogation. But even as somebody interrogating somebody, asking questions in an experiential way, for records or for getting an experience log from somebody or an experience, report, you have to wonder about that moment of silence. you know, about why that moment of silence is there. And once again, if you let that silence exist, how are they going to fill the space?
Yeah. So silence can, you know, actually in a lot of these, a lot of these influencers that have courses where they're teaching people how to be more confident or whatever they're calling it. They sometimes try to teach people to use silence as a technique, and it doesn't seem genuine. It can get awkward. And if you apply that to interrogations or questioning someone, silence on the other end could also mean that they're trying to put together a story. And you have to be able to, again, pick that up through change and things that, you know. So if I ask someone a question and they hesitate a little bit, well, hesitation, again, is a high sign of deception because your brain's trying to put together the most attractive thing to say to make you look the best, to make you look innocent, to make you look, again, just the best. It's literally trying to put together the most attractive thing it possibly can.
Yeah.
And you said earlier, editing out those ums and that, those are fillers. Again, that's buying your brain time. We all do it. You can train that out of your language too.
Yep.
And that's powerful because now you're a better communicator. You're when you're speaking to an audience, it's clear. Again, saying less, getting more.
Well, and especially when it comes to that, the idea of A, letting somebody give you the data without you having to ask, gives you a much better perspective on them and gives you a much better idea of if they are fabricating something. If they are willing to just exposition for 20, 30 minutes about something, that's something that should also be taken into consideration.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about business and collecting information. So I've had the pleasure of learning elicitation, and at the highest level, the same elicitation skills our agencies use, and the same elicitation that has been used to collect information from businesses. And I've had the pleasure of training with the folks that wrote the books that actually trained our government and things like that on how to do it and how to collect this information. And, you know, there's some simple techniques that you can use to get information from folks. And again, it goes back to those being, well, one is being curious. And like you said, in the paranormal, I think curiosity is probably the best approach, being open-minded and being curious about it, because we love to talk about things that we're passionate about. We love to look clever. We love to look intelligent in front of people because that gives us value. And we love to surround ourselves with folks that want to listen. So if I'm talking to a couple people about, we'll go with something that's paranormal, and I'm getting eyebrow flashes and I'm getting smiles and grins and head tilts, and I can see that they're interested in me, that's giving me permission to continue talking. So I'm just going to talk all night.
Yeah.
That is a technique that can be used also if you understand what that is. So I can take that same situation and I can make myself look attractive to whoever's talking to me to keep them talking. I can make myself, I'm engineering that outcome. I can make myself look interested. I can engage with them. Yep. I can do all of those things. And I'm now eliciting more information.
And it's fascinating though. One of the videos, I was recently interviewed on Tom Reed's podcast. We went into a lot of the charlatans in the UFO UAP community, yeah, the Jaime Musans out there. And one of the big ones was, a great video that was done on the body language of, Stephen Greer and specifically also of Bob Lazar. and some of the ways in which the phraseology that he used as he tells his story, the difference between things like, I walked by the door and it was just sitting there, yeah, or I walked by the door and saw it in the room.
So I mentioned her last time, Megan, my girlfriend, amazing, one of the best things that's ever happened to me. And she's very patient when it comes. She's going to kill me for this. She's not patient. She's patient when it comes to me and this. And I make her watch videos and rewatch videos and point things out.
I'm the same way.
She entertains it. She supports it. I'm so grateful for that. We were literally just talking about how when people say things that are guilty or they're being manipulative, like, you just don't talk like that. People don't talk that way. And yeah, that is a sign too. Like, if you can pick that up, it's like, wait a minute. Normal people don't talk that way. You just don't talk that way, right?
Yeah.
And you can pick that up, and that is it. Because if it's a change in their baseline, if they're trying to either confuse you or take you further away from something, yep, if they're introducing things that just don't make any sense, and then they just keep going and going. I like to explain it. It's like the Bigfoot, right? If you met me out at the country store and I'm telling a Bigfoot story and you let me tell this story, well, now you've given me permission and you're not pushing back and you're not criticizing me. Now I feel like, well, I got a taker. He believes me. I can make that Bigfoot into anything I want it to be because you can't confirm nor deny it.
Yeah.
And that's something you have to watch out for when things are just, sometimes things are unexplainable, yes, but sometimes they're like, well, wait a minute, you're taking me down a road. You're forcing this narrative on me. And which, you know, Cash Patel, I believe I posted a video where you can tell he's forced a narrative, and it's a perfect example of the forced narrative. When I'm sitting back and going, there's no way. No, like, I can tell you're forcing a narrative.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of the same thing with the, you know, if something doesn't sound right, because people just don't talk that way. You don't talk like that. Or, you know, you're forcing me down a road I don't want to go. You know, it just doesn't feel right. You know, then that's when you get curious. That's when you kind of question it. That's when it will break down under scrutiny most of the time. You know,
well, and how frequently, to bring this back to the beginning of the conversation, how frequently is it that you just get that intuitive moment, Keith, where it's like, wow, no way.
So I'm always asked if I can turn it on or off, and the answer is I don't know, but I know it's never off. I'm always picking up on something in my environment, good or bad or indifferent. I'm constantly now scanning, collecting information and data, and I don't know if I'll ever use it, if it ever be necessary, but I'm picking it up. And I think that's a way that I say I'm getting the reps in. I'm practicing every day, every moment I leave my house. I'm starting to scan and pick things up. Well, so, yeah, go ahead.
And no, I was going to say, and you kind of have to. You like you said, it's not really off ever.
No, so being able to pick up on some of that, I think I don't look for deception, because I know that there's other things that are more important. What I truly see the most of is really just suffering. And all of the weight that people carry, because you can't hide that.
Yeah.
And you might be able to hide it sometimes and from some people, but from someone who is trained to see that and to understand what that is and what it looks like, I see that first more often than anything. And it makes me sad. And I talk about this a lot. It makes me sad. It makes me not even know I know that this is the road I've chosen. I know that this is passion. I love every second of it. but it makes me sad. It hurts. It hurts when I come back home and I walk through the door and I just, man, the world just sucks sometimes. And,
yeah.
And I see it and I can't unsee it. And I want to do something. And, that's the hard part, but yes, there's a lot of deception and you can see that too, but.
Well, and you know, you mentioned a moment ago, having worked with agencies, having worked with people who helped write the books that trained the agencies that gave people like Facebook their beautiful ideas of how to scrape data. And literally the example I give regularly, I don't know if you're a big TV watcher, many years ago, not even many, about 5-6 years ago, there was a show, Halt and Catch Fire. I believe it was on TNT, something like that. But it was basically about the Silicon Valley here in Texas, the beginning of personal computing and then going into the creation of the internet. And one of the problems that they had specifically with the beginning of personal computing was what's called the cooling ratio. And exactly how long between doing something and getting feedback, exactly how long that ratio is. And the fact of like, if you click your mouse and don't get the result within like half a second, you start banging your mouse, you know, things like that. And it was, for international business machines, people were used to waiting half a day for a calculation. Didn't matter. You know, like you were a scientist, you were an accountant. It was a machine that you were using that it's going to do the work. Whenever it spits it out, we're done. You know, but for the average user, it was, how do we make that addictive? How do we make the brain want to stay in that environment and keep using it as opposed to just going to the library to get the information, which we've been doing since like Alexandria.
Well, here's the scary part. And here's the,
go ahead.
Here's the answer that no one wants to hear.
Yeah.
So we are battling against a $1 trillion machine that we'll never be able to conquer because we're using a 200,000 year old machine that we don't know hardly anything about. Yeah. So, you know, all of these social media, giants and convert everything really, they have top neuroscientists working for them, top research scientists working for them. And they have billions of dollars to spend. They know exactly what it takes to override and gain that compliance out of another human, out of your brain, because that's the currency. You know, that's what they're all fighting for. And, you know, so every time your eyes go up and down, you know, they release a little bit of dopamine.
Yep.
And what happens? And look at your algorithms. What do our algorithms do? They go up and down. That swipe. And, you know, most people know that dopamine as like the reward system or the excitement, right? But truly dopamine is only there to motivate you to pursue something. So it's only active during the pursuit. So it's really the anticipation of what you're going to see next when you swipe is what's giving you that dopamine. Once you swipe and you see it, you're done. You're ready to move on. And that's where the conditioning comes in. And that's where the loss of attention comes in. So, you know, it's our attention spans have dropped dramatically.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And probably about, hey, Richard Adams, if you're out there, my friend Richard Adams actually was part owner of Breach.TV, which was kind of a YouTube-esque platform here in Austin for a while. And I remember him telling me that my shows metric out at about 20 minutes or so. And then they decline. He was like, you should consider cutting your shows. And at the time, like Dudes and Beer was, good God, man, sometimes it was 4 hours, you know? So it's always been a long form show. It's always been a show about long conversation, very, very coast to coast AM. And the fact of like, no, you should be doing long haul trucking while you tune in. Cause you may miss part of the conversation. And he'd be like, you know, you should chop things into 20 minutes. And I'm like, dude, When I talk about human trafficking, 20 minutes isn't even the legal definition of human trafficking.
Yeah.
Like there are topics I talk about where that's just like the opening salvo of a question that gets us moving. So yeah, if people can't tune in for 2 hours for a conversation, you have to wonder about that. And you really do have to think about that as far as society goes, because our brains work and absorb things in a different way.
Yeah. And a lot of that's unconscious too. And, yeah. And it's driving. And a lot of the stuff that was there way before this is still driving you. And, just going kind of, I'm going to try to bring it all together real
quick. Go ahead, please.
We're talking about Stephen Greer, the paranormal, yes. The questioning and the social engineering. But there's one thing to kind of, I'm going to give you, it's called fate. And,
okay.
It comes down to, people are trying to get your focus. So the moment you're focused on something, now they know they have you, and how you maintain that focus is you kind of, you constantly, throw things out there. So it's pictures on that topic. It's all the news outlets talking about that topic. That's going to get your focus. And, then there's kind of, you have, really just like an emotional tie to it. So anytime you see something that is coming after your focus, that's making you emotional, that now you have, the third bit to this is if you have people, we talked about authority earlier. If you have people that are of high status that are pushing this narrative or that are even changed their views to support this narrative, that's gaining, momentum, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the tribe. So you put it all together and that little bit of information you can see in a lot of what's happening right now. And you're sitting on the other end of this. So a good example would say, like in the situational awareness world, you have these preppers. And these preppers are, there's hardcore preppers and then there's like the beginner prepper.
Yep.
Well, the hardcore prepper is going to come on in his YouTube channel and he's going to talk about all the stuff you need and all of this equipment and all of this supply of food. And if you don't have this, you're not American. Well, you're sitting at home and going, well, I don't want to not be an American. I'm going to be like that. So
yeah,
he's got that, the focus, the emotion. He's got the authority. He's got a YouTube channel. You're watching him and now he's got a tribe. He's pulling you in. Now you want to be like that. And what he's done is created, he's created some separation. Now you're like that. Now you don't want to be like those guys.
Yep.
So now you've separated, right? You're in your little tribe, and that's what's happening all over.
Absolutely.
And you can see it.
Absolutely. I say it all the time. One of my production secrets is that I was once an on-air producer for Alex Jones. I have worked in mainstream media. I've worked in sidestream media. Both of them are equally as slanted, everybody. Both.
Yeah. Oh,
as equally as slanted. And I will say it all day long. Alex, I love you, bud. All right. But if you just took the news, cause the shtick is you take the news, you read it, you put it through the lens of history, you extrapolate to the worst case scenario, then you go to break and you sell a solution for the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And then you come back. And wash, rinse, repeat. And the thing is, if you just took the news and put it through the lens of history and let people decide, you'd have a hell of an informative show. But it's when you start literally using it, like you said, for that tribalistic mentality, for the idea of setting up an us versus them, for setting up literally a cortisol injection to the brain of fear. And a dialectic of fear in that kind of way, you need to look out for the fear. You need to be careful. They're looking for you. I say it in a punny way regularly. Alex always knew he was going to be right. He didn't know it was his candidate that would do it.
that fear, we were talking about the 3-Eye Atlas and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just, absolutely. If you look, anytime that fear is introduced,
Yep.
It's going to create compliance and suggestibility, and it's going to override. So anything your brain works, your brain can override anything above the lowest point. So your brainstem is going to override everything above that. And our brainstem is where, you know, that fight or flight comes in, the fear. So anytime fear is introduced, yep, now you have an entire population that's suggestible, that's compliant, and they're looking for, remember what I said earlier, humans are the only species that will follow an unstable leader.
That's right.
All you have to do, the moment you offer that solution, that eases that tension. It's just like the first person who talks with silence. We're so conditioned to ease that tension. It's okay. It's okay not to say anything. It's okay to step back a minute and go, wait a minute. You know, maybe we're not going to get blown up by this big asteroid that possibly might come by here. You know,
yeah.
Let me just give myself a minute.
Isn't coming by here.
Yeah.
By all trajectory, yeah, not coming by here, yeah, swinging out near Jupiter.
Yeah.
A little further away. You know.
But that goes back too to like you were talking about Stephen Grant on that, you know, those, yeah, guys coming together and talking and building that within their tribes, their, mm-hmm, communities,
yep,
and driving that narrative and really trying to push it. And sometimes I think they do it to stay relevant too. So it's always for their, you know, for self benefit, with that self preservation mode kicks in.
And it just came out all of a few weeks ago. Here's the New York Times article that has had the, yeah, community in kerfuffle about CIA admits government lied about UFO sightings, by, yeah, Leslie Keene, the same person who put out the black budgets, black money and UFOs article, yeah, that led to a lot of opening conversation. But it's literally the idea of, like, why would they have a PSYOP officer if we're busy making the PSYOP for them? Like, within the community, setting, yeah, it up and building it up, you know. So,
I was going to talk, I mean, we're going into, yeah, PSYOPs, yeah, but
absolutely.
Really, the one thing to pay attention to is the amount of time. Every PSYOP is going to start and end. Because that's what it's there. It's there to serve a purpose. It's there, yeah, for whatever the gain, you know, whatever personal gain they need it to be, whatever narrative they need. So you just pay attention to the timing of what's going on in the world. How long does it last? And then all of a sudden it goes away. No one's talking about it anymore. That's a PSYOP. It's that simple. You know, you, yeah, don't have to. You don't have to try to look any deeper, because you're never going to find all the answers. You just need to know that happened, something, yeah, else happened, and here we are.
Well, and the thing is, it doesn't have to have any magnanimous trumpet sounding result from the top of a mountain either. All it has to do is create divisiveness within a community. All it has, yeah, to do is shake foundations, you know? And that's exactly what this conversation of 3i Atlas has done. I have seen numerous, mm-hmm, people that I considered to be capital R researchers who have rabbit holed on this. And even the fact of, once again, the media taking a scientist statement, who it's their job to hyperbolically hypothesize, cool, as I keep saying on the show. To be like, yes, there is a 2% chance. It's coming from interstellar space. It may be a ship. You know,
one of the outstanding like points on this rating scale, that we're to kind of like see if there's a PSYOP, is cherry picking data.
Yes.
So like you just said it right there. You know, they're cherry picking the stuff from some certain people,
yeah,
from certain universities to talk about this stuff. And some of those universities, yeah, have been a part of history's biggest scandals. You know, I'm not going to mention
some of them. Some
yeah,
of them.
Yeah. You know, so
you can mention them. I have nothing at all for them to take, Keith.
Yeah. No. if you think about it, like Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You know, so I know there's a big scientist out there who's really into the aliens, and he's been all, yep, over right now.
Yeah.
He probably has a new book coming out. So he's been doing the tour talking
about
it.
I've seen no less than 3 books about 3i Atlas. And it's like, how? How?
Yeah.
It has been a thing for 2.5 months. How have you, unless you just fed it into AI and had something spit it out, there's no way that you have written a book of any great consequence anyway. That's just me. But you have to wonder about why these things are done and why they are perpetuated. The one thing I bring up regularly on this show is Facebook. I love Facebook. We are highly active on Facebook beyond all other platforms. However, Facebook, YouTube, just about all of them got initial rounds of funding from InQtel, the financial arm of the CIA and DARPA. And the one point I bring up regularly is, if you remember the ousting of Hosni Mubarak and the Arab Spring, that happened like in the days when Facebook, you still had to know people from college.
Yeah.
You know, but there were enough people that were rallied for a flag. You remember what a flash mob was?
Wow. Oh, yeah.
It wasn't just people dressing up for Thriller and dancing in a mall, folks. There was an account that was like, hey, everybody, we should go overtake the town square and oust Hosni Mubarak. And that's how the Arab Spring started, was on a Facebook post. And they never found that account.
You know? Since we're talking about Facebook and these psyops, but again,
fear agendas.
I keep going back to just compliance in the tribe, right? Well, you remember a couple of years ago when it was real popular to change your Facebook picture to a flag.
Mm.
Well, if anyone participated in that, they were putting what they believed in on there, or they were supporting whatever.
Yep.
But in the big scheme of things, it was really just to see, you know, they're collecting this information.
Yeah.
And they're creating that division. They're creating that separation. And they're seeing it's compliance. Okay, who's going to do this? Oh, now we know that they're going to do this. We're going to feed them all this stuff through their algorithm. Facebook has been busted so many times.
Oh, God, yes.
For messing with people on there and taking certain groups and filling in information and stuff like that. So
I am getting ready to do a video, and I've got to get a couple of cameras that can be side by side, one in infrared, one in regular with time code. I had a friend of mine one night. His wife's an Insta person. She was scrolling Insta, and we were just like sitting outside having a cigar, you know, and he had the baby monitor on. He's like, check this out. I noticed this the other night. And while she was scanning, about every 30 seconds or so, and this was in the infrared, not on like regular camera, you saw the camera take a picture. Like actively, it was like an infrared scan of the face.
Yeah. Are you familiar with that?
I was like, oh my God, dude, they could be looking at her pupillary distance, at her pupillary response, whether or not she's interested in what she just scrolled past. Like the noodle just started overcooking so fast, Keith.
You don't even have to overthink it because it's happening, right? So are you familiar with, I think it's Vault 7?
Not offhand, no.
Yeah, you can. I think it's Vault 7, but it was basically the CIA WikiLeaks leak of all of their some of their operations. I think it's called Vault 7. If you just type in CIA WikiLeaks leak, you'll find it pop up. But there was an operation in there. I think it was Operation Couch Potato, maybe, where they had to basically release this information that they can turn your TV into a listening device, and they have that technology. So you can do your TVs, your phones. And I think either the Google Nest or the Google system that people put in their house was actually used in court against a domestic violence case, I believe it was, going back to that, and someone was being accused of something, and they actually listened in on the device and realized that they were not telling the truth. So yeah, these things, they've been doing it from day one, but we know that some of our adversaries are already doing it. They built these backdoor things in there.
And I've got the article from NPR.org up right now. This stuff came out in like 2015 when the president of Samsung said, like, yes, your TV is listening to you. And most of that is literally for programmatic advertising. I sent a message the other day. Yeah. It was literally right after we chatted about doing this interview that night. Somebody on our crew had some Taco Bell and things didn't go well and they didn't show up the next day. My friend, I'm not a Taco Bell eater. I'm not cruising for Taco Bell. I'm not looking for Taco Bell. I don't really drive by one regularly, okay? All day long, the talk was making fun of Taco Bell. Taco Bell. The next day, I woke up and within 15 minutes, had no less than 8 Taco Bell ads on my Facebook feed. And I took a screenshot and sent it. And I was like, screw you dudes for telling you. And all day long, people were like coming by like bean burrito, supreme burrito with cheese, like, like whispering Taco Bell things at my phone. But literally,
they can tell what,
literally.
They know what side of the bed you sleep on.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the deal. Like you can't. Again, it's a trillion-dollar computer system that we're not ready for.
Well, and the thing is, our brain is also that computer system, and one that is so easily hacked in that kind of way, and literally just steered. Like I said, I don't have it. I have it in my collection, but I didn't pull it out beforehand. The CIA Manual of Psychological Manipulation.
I probably have that in here somewhere.
And it's one of those, it's out there. Yeah. It's not hard to do those things. And as I've said before, as we said last week with Reverend Michael J.S. Carter about the 3i Atlas stuff, if anything, I believe it to be a litmus test. I believe it to be a litmus test as to the community, how the community will react, all those things. There are many articles out there. There are most of them from science-based news, stuff like that, SciTech Daily, that kind of stuff, who really get into the science behind things. But when you are looking at 95% of the mainstream media on either side of the aisle and even internationally, they are just feeding into the hype.
Yeah,
it's
fascinating
to see that.
It's that collective, you know, sharing all of that same information.
How can
that's what you have to be careful for.
Well, I was just about to say, we've got you for a few more minutes here. How can not only we as investigators into these things, Keith, how can we steer clear of that pitfall? The one that I point out all the time as Curious Research when I speak and as Curious Realm on the show, that horrible pitfall of want of confirmation married with confirmation bias. The idea that our brain just will not accept, like a brick wall doesn't accept water, you know, like how do you get past that as somebody, and how do you really get to the truth of things in that discerning kind of way?
Yeah. Well, first, like I said, you got to take a step back for a second. And if you're constantly seeing I'm trying to simplify this so it's applicable. But
sure,
if you're seeing, again, collective narratives spread out across the big mega outlets, right? So if they're kind of saying the same things, be wary of that. Again, be wary of timing. What is going on in the world? So you kind of have to open up your world a little bit. You got to get a little worldly and pay attention to something outside of your neighborhood, outside of your country sometimes.
Yeah. But
what's going on? So timing, pay attention to that collective narrative being thrown out there. And kind of like looking for a uniform messaging, but also missing information. Because there's bridges between the truth and something made up. And again, that authority? Who's saying these things? Who's changing their beliefs or their views to go with this, go along with this, and pay attention to that. And if you just pay attention to that, you're going to be way more prepared than most other people. And if you find yourself getting emotional, if you find yourself getting heated, angry, sad, frustrated, you got to take a step back and say, whoa, what triggered me there? And I'll say trigger. I don't like that word, but that's what's happening. That's how we recognize that.
Sure.
So whatever, you have to take a step back and say, why am I feeling this way right now? Again, and asking yourself the question. So the truth is inside here. The truth you're seeking is going to come from within, because your body is the number one security system ever created. There isn't an AI system that can outperform your own central nervous system when it comes to intuition and keeping you safe. So but the problem is the algorithms, the sense of the lack of delayed gratification, all that, you're overriding those natural, innate inborn security systems that we have through our ancestors, and it's just in your DNA. But if you take a step back and you go, wait a minute, why is it making me feel that way? What did I just watch? What did I see before that? Or what comes after that? Because that once you get emotional, now you override logic. And that's what they're looking for. That's what they want. Because remember what I said earlier, your brain will override anything above the lowest point. Well, your emotion hits right towards the bottom, right in the, towards the middle to the bottom there in that limbic system, that brainstem. And it's going to override the top, which is your executive function area, that prefrontal cortex where we make our decisions. So that can be overridden through emotion. So you have to be careful. That's what they want. And that keeps you in that suggestive mode. Yeah. It keeps you in that fear mode, that flee, fight, flight mode.
Absolutely. And one of the things I bring up regularly is the idea of forced perspective. I'm going to pop up a picture of it real quick for any of the viewers, just so you understand it. Forced perspective for the listeners out there is the images that you see where like somebody's holding the Eiffel Tower between their index finger and thumb, like pinching it, that kind of stuff. But when I say forced perspective, that also means the fact of like when you're on social media, are they trying to force that dialogue? Are they trying to squeeze that dialogue into a small confined space with a crowbar?
Yeah.
And things like an anonymous post where you can't track the source, an image that's just a meme image and doesn't have a source, if it doesn't have like a news source, something like that attached to it, consider that. Those are things that you should just take in as cold points of data that somebody is trying to force your perspective on something. And not necessarily give you the clearest image that may be possible. So,
that forced narrative is out there all over.
Absolutely. Man, I can't thank you enough for the conversation tonight, Keith. And I want to have this again and again and again, because I really think it is one of the most important concepts out there in the world of paranormal, parapsychological research, UFO, UAP, all of it, because we've got to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to media, what media is saying, as well as those out there that are experiencers, and not just experiencers, but experi-influencers. I'll coin the term now, experi-influencer.
I like it. I like it.
Because they're out there. It's one of those, like, it's fascinating to see the way that the culture and the example I give regularly is Corey Good, where he came onto the scene. He came onto the scene strong. There were many, many people that latched onto him and latched onto the story. And come to find out later through his own deposition, like, Anybody who believes in the Blue Avians the way he put it forth is delusional, despite the fact that he shook their hands, hugged them, sold them a book, sold them a DVD, signed them, said, wow, I'm glad you had that experience too. They're delusional, you know, so it's interesting to see that. And those are the dangers of the community and even the fact of those things. And the Three-Eye Atlas fervor and everything else really does color the way that valid research looks at these things. And it also colors the way that experiencers feel about coming forth with their experiencer, their experience, you know?
Yeah.
So it affects a lot of things. You may not think, folks, that the conversation of the way that the community views these things or reacts to these things is that important. But it truly is, because it affects whether or not people come forward, no different than the conversation now with the hashtag MeToo movement being alive and well changes that conversation entirely from what it was when my mom was getting harassed as a single mother working in a male Salesforce environment in the 1980s, you know, so there's a different realm of accountability with those things because of movements and how things are seen. So it's important. So thank you so much for the time tonight, Keith. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to find out more about you, where they can go to book you, where they can go to find out more about Ape Mindset and becoming connected with their inner self and connected in a greater way with the world around them.
Yeah. Again, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Always. Looking forward to it again. We can always go deep on something. But yeah, you can find me at apemindset.com. I'm on social media, Instagram, at Evolve at Ape, at Facebook. You can find me. You can search my name. You can search the Ape LLC. And, you know, I'm approachable, so you can send me messages, Messenger. All my contact information is on there. If you really want to just help understand, you know, the world around you and the people around you on a deeper level, you know, that's what I'm here to do, to share all the knowledge that I have and the training that I have to help make it just a better place, a more comfortable place for folks to navigate, to really live with purpose and evolve that purpose. Anytime, even if it's just a simple question, just reach out to me. We can answer it. I can answer it. We'll have fun.
I can tell you right now, he answers the messages, folks. All right. Again, Keith, you are more than welcome on anytime. Even if you have something that you think bears discussing in the world, feel free to reach out. My audience.
We didn't even talk about the brain. I always have a brain with me. We can deep dive into that.
I'm jealous of your brain now. I mean, I already was jealous of your brain, but I didn't know you had a physical external brain as well.
A lot more information we can navigate through.
We'll definitely get into that and binaural beats and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You can start undoing some of the damage done by these things.
Oh, yeah. So, for sure.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. Yeah. While you are online checking out everything from Keith Click and apemindset.com, everybody, where you can go unlock your potential to connection to the world around you and better understand your personal intuition of things, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/knowledge is how you get to the knowledge vault. That's where you can find all kinds of awesome declassified government documents, including MKUltra, CIA reports, all kinds of things. That's also where you can find your link to Curious Research and the Field Observation and Encounter Log, everybody. Thank you so much for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services. CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.